We are, as a whole, an optimistic sort of bunch. Our universalist heritage, stretching back to the earliest days of the Protestant Reformation and beyond, taught that no one, not one single person, not even Hitler, was so separated from the love of God that they were beyond redemption. Our theological ancestors were the people who believed that no person was ever wholly or completely broken, that the spark of the divine dwelled within each soul, and that it remained burning even under the shadows of the very worst things that human beings are capable of doing to each other and to the world. And that doctrine mattered. It matters still. It's at the heart of what we do together, that flame still burns no matter what. In fact, that doctrine matters so much that it has spread. We used to have a monopoly on disbelief in hell, but it's not really our domain anymore. Many of the liberal Protestant and progressive religious groups in America have given up on those old-fashioned sermons about hell, fire, and brimstone that are seared into so many of our imaginations. It's one of those things that doesn't seem to claim our imaginations the way it used to. Devils yawning out of the abyss to claim unruly boys and girls have gone the way of mean nuns with smacky rulers. They just aren't as present as we might have once thought. And most people want to believe, or at least try to believe, that human beings are more than just the broken, sinful souls who were tempted by an apple and a devilish serpent in a garden so long ago. We have come a long way, I think. Yet I, along with some scholars of liberal religion, have begun to wonder if we've actually gone a little too far in our assessment of human nature and our general disbelief in an entity or force one might call evil at all. In a very dry essay, which I recently published and do not particularly recommend you read, I lay out an argument for why we liberal religious types should consider taking evil more seriously. Not as something that is out there ready to pounce on us, but as something that is very present in our lives and in this world, something that we are absolutely fooling ourselves if we think we can ignore, something we can experience, whether we admit it or not, that makes its way into our lives and in our days. In that essay, I quote the former president of Amnesty International, Bill Scholz, who challenges what he perceives to be an unwillingness on the part of some Unitarian Universalists to directly address the reality of suffering and sinfulness in this world. He says we sometimes use our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, as an excuse to forego really understanding our deep capacity for doing evil. If we choose to hide behind an unexamined understanding of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, he questions if we can ever really bring healing to the searing and profound and real issues of our day, issues no less painful than war and torture and genocide. We can't bring ourselves to look directly at humanity's present brokenness. How, he wonders, can we ever bring it to a place of greater wholeness? He calls to task our tendency to use the inherent worth and dignity of every person to justify an optimistic worldview, a view of human nature that gives us no real grounding for dealing with the very present realities of this suffering. Somehow, it helps us to grasp the fallacy that people are somehow dealing with an evil merely beyond themselves, in another place, in another time, outside our best efforts. an idea that evil is out there, not in here, and not a part of our daily lives. Scholes writes, "If we no longer believe that human beings are made in the likeness of God, are we not still reticent to dwell upon the features of the flesh that make us not just slightly lower than the angels, but out of the angels' league altogether? Do we even have a commonly shared doctrine of human nature today? And if we do, is it sufficient to explain why the most reputable souls, under the right circumstances, can be transformed into savages?" We do not, after all, live in a world where our actual experiences of human beings are a natural antecedent for our general optimism about the human condition. Most of our children who are today forming their first ideas about humanity and morality were born in the decade of September 11. They have already lived through multiple wars, through Abu Ghraib, Hurricane Katrina, Darfur, the Virginia Tech shootings, and the economic and natural disaster in Haiti. They are not blind to these things, nor are we, the adults who love them. And if we are to have a faith that matters to them, those who have lived in these days, whose very ideas have formed in these days, I truly believe that we are called for them and for one another to have something real to say in the face of such suffering. Something that can carve meaning out of that kind of desolation. If, after all, a faith such as ours has no willingness to admit the presence of an unimaginable suffering and our relative smallness before it, what are we supposed to say to the wounded? What are we supposed to say to the refugee, to the soldier who comes back from war having seen more than she ever could have imagined? If we are something more than a great place to hang out when things are going well, we must pay attention to the suffering of the world instead of running away from it. And it is not just people out there somewhere who know the faces that evil wears. It is all of us in here who need some tending too. We whose wounds must be salved. We whose bodies have been broken by violence. We who must face the evil we know. We should, I think, be able to minister to one another through light and through darkness. And we should find comfort for the lost and the lonely that is deeper than the statement that even they, even then, have inherent worth and dignity. We should offer them more than dignity. We should offer them comfort. I've often mused over the oft-quoted dictum of 19th century Unitarian leader James Freeman Clark, who said that liberal religion, and Unitarianism in particular, was defined by its emphasis on, quote, the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. The progress of mankind onward and upward forever. Perhaps it is a product of living in these particular days. But the idea of progress onward and upward forever, unimpeded by pain or darkness, never has made any sense to me. Like Scholes, I find that the insistence within our tradition upon an energizing rhetoric of over-optimism never seems to be very honest. It's not as honest as the simple act of being with those in crisis, with a theology deep enough to heal, a theology that demonstrates our willingness to work for justice in this world as it is, and to continue working in the face of violence, oppression, and good old-fashioned human sinfulness. Now, I know I'm throwing around some very loaded terms today. I did not expect that would be easy. I'm throwing around words like evil and sin as if they're easy to understand and as if we have some form of unified definition for them, which of course we do not. If you've read this month's newsletter, you can see that my colleague Rebecca Parker defines evil as evil operating as fraud, pomp, and greed manifests itself itself as large-scale systems that disrespect and deny human needs, that disrupt human longings, that exploit resources without replenishment, just to maintain the social order through treating human beings with violence. Basically, I think she's saying that evil is the thing that breaks people and communities and lives apart. It's not something that happens to us. It's not something that nature can even visit upon us, but something we do to ourselves. It's the living out of the very worst of our nature. Sure, she says, we can ask what evil is, and we can ask if it exists, but the real work, the business we're supposed to be about, is figuring out how to stop doing it so darn often. I would add that our work includes the all-important task of figuring out how to start again, even in the aftermath of destruction. One scholar of evil has said that there are several myths about evil that are popular in our culture. One of those myths is that evil is conducted by people or powers wholly different than us, completely other. Another is that evil is equivalent to original sin. We're evil by nature and there's not a thing we can do about it, so we better just pray. That first myth, the idea that evil is out there in some other darker, more devilish place, those for whom, God willing, we may never see or encounter or come to know, that idea that evil is somewhere else is pervasive in our society. We perceive that the great wrongs of our age are wrought by others in some other place too far away for us to impact. Yet the fact is that whether evil is or is not what we think it is, it's all around us all the time. It's present in the very mundane details of our lives. And figuring out how to limit its power over us is an ever-present struggle in the lives of most normal people. But that's not the end of the story. Because we come from a tradition that affirms the possibility and power inherent in each and every human being, the fact that evil, the destruction of love, the destruction of connection is present all around us, the fact that it's there shouldn't have to mean that we're consumed by it, or broken by it in a way that can never be redeemed. Just because it's there doesn't mean it has to be in charge. Just because we're flawed doesn't mean we're irreparably broken. Quite the contrary. We are choosing creatures. In all of this vast landscape of complexity and evolutionary wonder, we're the ones who evolved the capacity for moral thought and just and unjust action. We are the ones who invented evil, and we are the ones who have the power to control it bit by bit with every tiny choice we make. To prove my point, I turn to the wisdom of a great sage, namely Captain James T. Kirk. Yes, that's true. I know you marvel at my sources. In an episode from the original Star Trek, not the Next Generation or any of the subsequent better produced but sadly Shatnerless sequels, there is a conversation in which James T. Kirk tries to tell a group of aliens who are about to slide into total warfare that violence is not inevitable, that the darkness about to claim them can be overcome. Their conversation goes thusly. Alien. There can be no peace, don't you see? We've admitted it to ourselves. We are a killer species. It is instinctive. It is the same with you. Kirk. All right, it's instinctive. But the instinctive can be fought. We are human beings with the blood of a million savage years on our hands, but we can stop it. We can admit that we are killers, but we're not going to kill today. That's all it takes. Knowing that you're not going to kill today. I think Jim is on to something. I don't believe with our optimistic ancestors in the progress of humankind onward and upward, uninterrupted forever toward a shining city on the hill, perfect and without war and without suffering. I really don't believe it. I've tried. And I cannot convince myself that we will ever make it to the shining city on a hill that we imagine, where none will starve and none will die and all will be well. I know this world too well to believe in such an earthly paradise, but I do believe we can do better. Starting with each decision that presents itself to us each and every day, we can do better. Today, we can choose differently. We are not evil creatures. We are choosing creatures. And today, the child with the gun can put it down and walk away. Today, we can, if only for our own part, cease to promote hatred in the name of race, class, gender, sexual orientation, or faith identity. Today, we can live out the better side of our flawed nature, and that choice can impact the future for the better. Today, we don't have to hurt one another. Tomorrow will bring a fresh set of choices, and even when we have failed, for we will fail, someone has to come along behind the armies and shovel the rubble to the roadsides and put up new walls and plant grass where the dead bodies once lay. Someone has to begin again, and the choice to do so is always available to us. In the conclusion of his paper, Bill Scholes related an important story about how he's come to understand the human struggle with and against evil. He's speaking of a great chess master when he says, "Chancing upon a great painting in a European gallery of a defeated Faust sitting opposite the devil at a chess table with only a knight and a king on the board and the king in check, the chess master stopped to stare. The minutes changed to hours, and still the master stared. And then finally, 'It's a lie!' he shouted. 'The king and the knight have another move. They have another move.' And that is finally what the experience of living with human evil has taught me, that it's not just the king and the knight, not just the queen but the rook, not just the bishop but the pawn, it's not just the wealthy but also the pauper, not just the fortunate but also the weary, not just the torturer but also the tortured, not just the powerful but every single blessed person until the day we die. Every single blessed person on this earth, every single blessed person has another move. We all have another move. In the end, it is not that we Unitarian Universalists are overly optimistic about human nature. It's not that evil doesn't touch our lives or that we could ever wholly ignore it if we tried. It is the fact that we have another move that saves us. Even in the darkness, even when we have failed miserably and our lesser angels have taken the day, we can begin again. We all have another move, and we all have the power to make it. May it be so, and amen."